Greetings, Tacoma. John Doherty here once again for KTAH 101.9's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate and every once in a while things that don't have anything to do with climate just because we feel like it. Always respectfully, all points of view are welcome and we need to understand all points of view. We need to understand each other. Climate's a huge challenge. We're not doing a very good job of meeting the challenge. And part of the reason we're not doing a good job is because we're not paying attention to each other. So in that regard, I am interested in what you think. You can send me an email at any time at johnjohn@cclTacoma.org. That CCL part is for Citizens Climate Lobby. I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby and some other groups too, of course. And if you'd like to know more about Citizens Climate Lobby, you can check out the website at ccltacoma.org. By the way, I've got a document, a link there, 100 things you can do to reduce your carbon footprint. So if you're concerned about the future, it's nice to know what we can do as individuals. Find something on there, take it on, do it, then find something else. So I did receive an email from a listener. A few episodes ago, I had made the comment that according to the Carbon Tracker organization, India is doing pretty well in meeting their Paris Climate Accords. That's the Accords of 2015. And at the same time, we in the United States are doing about as bad as you can. This writer of the email brought up the issue about, well, what were the standards that India was being measured by? And it's a good question, and obviously the person who wrote me the email has been doing his homework, something which all of us should be doing. So here's the issue. Countries who signed the Paris Accord, which is just about every country, agreed to reduce their emissions by a certain amount, and the overall intention of the agreement was that Earth emissions would be limited to the point where climate would not warm by more than 1.5 degrees centigrade by 2050. All sounds good enough, although the question can be asked and should be asked, so what is the standard from which we are starting in reaching those goals? And unfortunately, in the Paris Accords, the standard was left up to the individual countries. I gotta say that getting any kind of agreement out of 180 or 190 countries has got to be an amazing challenge in just itself, so the fact that it's not a perfect agreement is totally understandable. However, we should understand what the structure and what perhaps some of the weaknesses versus strengths are in that accord. And that's exactly what my writer was referring to. As a baseline, India used something that's called emissions intensity of its economy. So my understanding of that is that it's something like the percentage of carbon emissions would grow more slowly than the overall growth of the economy. And stating once again, this is my understanding, and if you've got a different spin on this, I'd love to hear it. My understanding is, for instance, let's say in a 5-year period that a country's economy grew by 10%, and if the fossil fuel emissions increased by only 8%, then that would be an improvement. An improvement looked at that way, but of course it is an 8% increase in fossil fuel emissions. And not all countries did this. India was one of them, and that was the point that my writer was making, and it's a valid point. So let's take a look at what's going on with India and China versus the United States and what that means for the future. I got a quote from Oprah Winfrey some time ago, at least I think it was from her. The quote goes something like this: "Nothing can make for a good argument like two people who don't know what they're talking about." So let's take a look and see what we're talking about. Let's start from some kind of reasonably fact-based place here. What are the Paris Accord standards? Basically, the Paris Accord is a binding and universal agreement, and it's designed to limit greenhouse gas emissions to levels that would prevent Earth's temperature from rising above 2 degrees centigrade, or that's about 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's above a benchmark set before the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, say 1750. So we're several years into that agreement, and it's fair to ask, okay, how are we doing? So I'm relying on a website called Climate Action Tracker. I recommend it to you. It's a Climate Action Tracker. If you ever want to know how countries are doing around the world in terms of carbon emissions, that's a one-stop shop. They're just a fact-based database organization. Doesn't seem to have any particular axe to grind. They're just saying what it is. So who are meeting the standards so far? Well, it's not a long list out of the 180 or 190 countries we're talking about. We've got Gambia, Morocco, Philippines, Kenya, India, Ethiopia, Costa Rica, and Bhutan. Those countries are meeting standards that would limit the increase in temperature to 2 degrees centigrade or less. Okay, how's China doing? China is listed as highly insufficient, just as we might have thought based on news reports and so on that we see. So how is the United States measured in this system? They're called critically insufficient, along with Russia and a few other bad actors. So one of my themes here today is it's easy enough to throw rocks at India and China, but maybe we should be looking in the mirror first. Not to say that India and China don't matter. Absolutely they do. We're not going to let them off the hook either. I think in pointing to carbon emissions from India and China, a couple of conclusions are drawn by skeptics or pessimists. One of them is that, well, we can't solve this problem if China and India are not going to be part of the solution. And a stepsister to that, if they're not meeting standards, if they're polluting, why should we stop? So I would say that those criticisms of China and India are probably warranted, at the least if we hold the United States to the same standards that we want to hold India and China to. You know, there's a human tendency to want to blame other folks for things that are not right, and this is a classic example of it. It's not our fault, it's India's and China's fault, and then we can go on our merry way, not change our behavior, not change our politics, not change our energy use. So first, let's take a look at historical emissions between these three countries. The United States has emitted more CO2 than anybody else since the start of the Industrial Revolution, about 400 billion tons since 1750s or so. And by the way, these tons that I'm referring to are metric tons, or approximately 2,200 pounds. Although these huge numbers, we really can't get our arms wrapped around what they actually mean, so they're really useful in terms of comparisons. So 400 billion tons from the United States since 1750. China, by comparison, has only produced about half of that. We've produced 25% of the world's historical emissions. China's produced about 12%, and India's production is tiny compared to those two because of their late start into industrialization. None of which is to let China off the hook. Right now, China as a country is the world's largest emitter of fossil fuel emissions. I think looked at this way, and that is country by country, is not telling the full picture in a very significant way, however. So I want to talk about what the per capita emissions are. And simply put, per capita means per person. So in this model, you take the total output of a country, and then you divide that by the population, and that would give you the per capita output or the per capita footprint. And that's one important way of comparing what's going on around the world and between countries and who's doing what and how badly. So here's a look at a few countries' per capita carbon dioxide emissions. This is in tons once again. In the United States, we're emitting 16.1 metric tons per person. That's every man, woman, and child. Same in Canada, 16.1 metric tons per person. Okay, so how is China doing? 8.0 metric tons per person. So China's a big country with a lot of people, big population, and their per capita carbon dioxide output is half of what it is in the United States, and that's right now. So it seems like a stretch to me to be throwing rocks at China saying, look at all the CO2 you're producing. How about India? India's tiny, really, in terms of per capita. Once again, a country with a very big population, 1.9 metric tons per person. How are other Western countries doing? About the same as the United States. Australia's a little bit worse at 16.8. But there are Western countries that are doing very well. Germany is 9.1 metric tons per person. Norway, 9.4. So the message there is that we can have successful, vibrant economies, and we can have a reduced carbon output at the same time. There are some other factors that are kind of outside this raw data. For instance, China is building lots of coal-fired electric plants outside of China as they expand their reach into the third world and across into the Middle East. These are all plants that are off the books, so to speak, for China. And there's another angle to look at here. We've exported a lot of our manufacturing from the United States to China in the last 30 years or so. So in a sense, we've exported the emissions associated with those manufacturing operations. In a sense, we as consumers of Chinese goods here in the United States have sent our footprint, or at least a part of it, over to China. They get to count it. We don't, but we're really the ones that are profiting from that carbon emission. So here's what I'm talking about. Let's say there were a manufacturing plant on the border with Mexico that was producing X tons per year of carbon dioxide. For whatever reason, the owners of that plant decided to move it just across the border into Mexico. Now it becomes Mexico's carbon dioxide, not the United States carbon dioxide, yet the manufactured goods are all destined to the United States. So we need to be careful when we're looking at one country versus the other. The bottom line to me is carbon dioxide doesn't respect borders in any kind of way. And so to go into politics and blame and finger pointing really isn't going to get us where we need to be. And China, to their credit, are very worried about their atmospheric conditions. As you've probably read and seen, the pollution in the major cities in China is a huge problem, and it's one that they've got to address. They're kind of stuck with the problem we're dealing with here in the United States around the COVID in a way, and that is doing the right thing, defeating the COVID versus keeping the economy going. So China's dealing with the same thing, using coal for energy to build up their economy while they recognize at the same time that it's damaging their environment. So some attaboys for China. Right now, about half of the electric vehicles in the world are operated in China, and 90% of the world's electric buses operate in China. And those two things right there have made a major step towards reducing the pollution to an extent in China. Beijing used to be one of the most polluted cities in the world in terms of airborne pollution, and right now they're not even in the top 200 most polluted cities, so they are making some progress there. How's China doing on renewable energy? Well, they're doing okay. They produce about 25% of their power from renewable sources. That includes solar and wind, of course. And here in the United States, we produce 11% of our energy from renewable sources. So once again, we need to be cautious when we decide to start throwing rocks at China or India. So with all of that, let's just talk about the Paris Accords for a minute, see where they fit in with everything. So to meet the Paris goals, the scientists are saying that coal power needs to be reduced by 70% by 2030 and phased out completely by 2050. That's from an organization called the Global Energy Monitor. It's a nonpartisan place to go get data. I encourage you to take a look at it if you want to dig in deeper. So does anybody anywhere think that we're actually going to accomplish that? Right now, only 8 countries out of the 180 or 190 countries that signed the Paris Agreement are meeting their own commitment, and most countries are far from meeting their own commitments. So just my own opinion here, and I hope I'm not overstating the case, but I gotta say that the Paris Accord is a basket case that, effectively speaking, has no chance whatsoever of limiting temperature rise to 2 degrees centigrade, much less 1.5 degrees. So just to be clear here, I'm not saying there shouldn't be a Paris Accord. Countries should be talking to each other. We should be recognizing the problem. We should be undertaking plans and sticking to those plans to recognize the problem of CO2 emissions. What I'm saying is that if we're going to rely on the Paris Accords to save us, we're relying on something that's not going to save us. We hear the expression frequently these days about solutions for climate change, global warming, and it's said that there is no silver bullet, and what's called for is silver buckshot. That's the term that's in vogue right now. And I got to say that it's probably got an important message in it. There's not just one thing that we can do to address the problem of global warming. However, with that said, the one thing I believe that could be effective in reducing our carbon output would be to put a fee on carbon from the producers or the border where it comes across the border, and to give that money in a cashback format to the population. And that cashback would be, once again, on a per capita basis. Each individual, each child would get the same amount. So an average family, if we did that under proposals that are right now in the U.S. Congress, that would result in a $300 or $400 a month payment to families to help them offset the increased price of that carbon and to transition to cleaner uses of energy. One of the key things in a proposal such as this is the issue of what other countries are doing. And I get to an extent the argument, well, if other countries aren't going to be a part of the program, that's a problem. It is a problem. Carbon dioxide doesn't respect borders. We have to reduce carbon dioxide where it's being produced all over the world. So a carbon fee with a dividend in the form of cashback payments would be a very effective way of influencing the policies of other countries. Those bills that address this call for a border adjustment. So countries that are bringing goods into the United States, like let's say China, for instance, would have to pay an offsetting fee for the carbon use that they undertake and to not put our own producers at a disadvantage. Well, in that case, China, for instance, would be paying the United States that carbon fee. If they charge it to their own producers, then they would be gatekeeping the money in China. So there'd be a very big motivation for them to put a fee on carbon as well. And that would, according to plan, reduce the amount of carbon dioxide that used. Only makes sense since they put a price on something, people use less of it. The bill in Congress is H.R. 763. That's the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. Our representatives here, Denny Hecker, Derek Kilmer, depending on where you live, are both co-sponsors of that bill. It's a very serious bill. It's a very well thought out bill, and I encourage you to look into it and see what it says and see what you think, and let your elected representatives know after you've done that. One of the advantages of this kind of approach is it's really not a partisan thing. I think a solution that we come up with that involves political agreements and laws that are not bipartisan is that the stuff goes away with the next change of regime or whatever. A fee such as this becomes a part of how we do business and it lasts over time. And just as good evidence that it is a nonpartisan approach, there's a Baker-Schultz proposal that basically says the same thing. They don't have a bill in Congress right now, but essentially they're proponents of the same kind of approach to reducing carbon emissions. So about time to wrap up here. I'm going to be putting some web references on the website for you to look at if you want to follow up with some of the organizations I've mentioned in this program. You can go to ccltacoma.org and easily find under resources or somewhere else on that site references today's program, and I encourage you to do that. Also, I was pleased that today's program was inspired by an email from a listener, so I'd love to hear from you also. What would you like to talk about? You can contact me at John, J-O-H-N, at ccltacoma.org. And once again, also reminding you that that website I just mentioned, you can find a document, 100 Ways You Can Reduce Your Own Carbon Footprint. So that's it for today. It's been great talking to you. And once again, I'm reminding you, as always, live like the mountain's out. Take care now.